Sons of Mary on a hilltop named Kibeho were investigated by the Catholic Church and announced to be reliable. The wife of the Rwandan president, Agatha Habyarimana, was specially entranced by these visions and maintained a close relationship with the Bishop of Kigali, Rwanda's capital city. This man, Monsignor Vincent Nsengiyumva, was also a central committee member of President Habyarimana's single ruling party, the National Revolutionary Movement for Development, or NRMD. This party, together with other organs of state, was fond of rounding up any women of whom it disapproved as prostitutes, and of encouraging Catholic activists to trash any stores that sold contraceptives. Over time, the word spread that prophecy would be fulfilled and that the cockroaches, the Tutsi minority, would soon get what was coming to them. When the apocalyptic year of 1994 actually hit and the premeditated and coordinated massacres began, many frightened Tutsi and dissident Hutu were unwise enough to try and take refuge in churches. This made life considerably easier for the Interahamwe, or government and military death squads, who knew where to find them and who could rely on priests and nuns to point out the locations. This is why so many of the mass grave sites that have been photographed are on consecrated ground, and it is also why several clergymen and nuns are in the dock at the ongoing Rwandan genocide trials. The notorious Father Wenceslas Munyashyaka, for example, a leading figure at the Kigali Cathedral of Saint-Famille, was smuggled out of the country with the assistance of French priests, but he has since been charged with genocide, with providing lists of civilians to the Interahamwe, and with the rape of young refugee women. He's by no means the only cleric to have faced similar charges. Lest it be thought that he was merely a rogue priest, we have the word of another member of the Rwandan hierarchy, the Bishop of Gikongoro, otherwise known as Monsignor Augustin Misago. To quote one careful account of these atrocious events, Bishop Misago was often described as a Hutu power sympathizer. He had been publicly accused of barring Tutsis from places of refuge, criticizing fellow members of the clergy who helped cockroaches, and asking a Vatican emissary who visited Rwanda in June 1994 to tell a pope to find a place for Tutsi priests because the Rwandan people do not want them anymore. What's more, on May 4 of that year, shortly before the last Marian apparition at Kibeho, the bishop appeared there himself with a team of policemen and told a group of 90 Tutsi schoolchildren who were being held in preparation for slaughter not to worry, because the police would protect them. 3 days later, the police helped to massacre 82 of the children. Schoolchildren held in preparation for slaughter. Perhaps you remember the Pope's denunciation of this ineffaceable crime and of the complicity of his church in it? Or perhaps you do not, since no such comment was ever made. Paul Rusesabagina, the hero of Hotel Rwanda, remembers Father Wenceslas Munyashyaka referring even to his own Tutsi mother as a cockroach. But this did not prevent him, before his arrest in France, from being allowed by the French church to resume his pastoral duties. As for Bishop Misago, there were those in the post-war Rwandan Ministry of Justice who felt that he should be charged as well. But as one of the officials of the ministry phrased it, "The Vatican is too strong and too unapologetic for us to go taking on bishops. Haven't you heard of infallibility?" At a minimum, this makes it impossible to argue that religion causes people to behave in a more kindly or civilized manner. The worse the offender, the more devout he turns out to be. It can be added that some of the most dedicated relief workers are also believers, though as it happens the best ones I have met are secularists who are not trying to proselytize for any faith. But the chance that a person committing the crimes was faith-based was almost 100%, while the chances that a person of faith was on the side of humanity and decency were about as good as the odds of a coin flip. Extend this back into history and the odds become more like those of an astrological prediction that just happens to come true. This is because religions could never have got started, let alone thrived, unless for the influence of men as fanatical as Moses or Muhammad or Joseph Kony. While charity and relief work, while they may appeal to tender-hearted believers, are the inheritors of modernism and the Enlightenment. Before that, religion was spread not by example, but as an auxiliary to the more old-fashioned methods of holy war and imperialism. I was a guarded admirer of the late Pope John Paul II, who by any human standards was a brave and serious person, capable of displaying both moral and physical courage. He helped the anti-Nazi resistance in his native country as a young man, and in later life did much to assist its emancipation from Soviet rule. His papacy was in some ways shockingly conservative and authoritarian, but showed itself open to science and inquiry, except when the AIDS virus was under discussion, and even in its dogma about abortion made some concessions to a life ethic, which, for example, began to teach that capital punishment was almost always wrong. On his death, Pope John Paul was praised, among other things, for the number of apologies he had made. These did not include, as they should have done, an atonement for the million or so put to the sword in Rwanda. However, they did include an apology to the Jews for the centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, an apology to the Muslim world for the Crusades, an apology to Eastern Orthodox Christians for the many persecutions that Rome had inflicted upon them too, and some general contrition about the Inquisition as well. This seemed to say that the Church had mainly been wrong and often criminal in the past, but was now purged of its sin by confession and quite ready to be infallible all over again. Chapter 14. There is no Eastern solution. The crisis of organized religion in the West and the numberless ways in which religious morality has actually managed to fall well below the human average has always led some anxious seekers to pursue a softer solution east of Suez. Indeed, I once joined these potential adepts and acolytes, donning orange garb and attending the ashram of a celebrated guru in Pune in the lovely hills above Bombay. I adopted this sannyas mode in order to help make a documentary film for the BBC. So you may well question my objectivity if you wish, but the BBC at that time did have a standard of fairness, and my mandate was to absorb as much as I could. One of these days, having in the course of my life been an Anglican, educated at a Methodist school, converted by marriage to Greek Orthodoxy, recognized as an incarnation by the followers of Sai Baba, and remarried by a rabbi, I shall be able to try and update William James's Varieties of Religious Experience. The guru in question was named Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Bhagwan simply means God or godly, and Sri means holy. He was a man with huge soulful eyes and a bewitching smile, and a natural if somewhat dirty sense of humour. His sibilant voice, usually deployed through a low-volume microphone at early morning darshan, possessed a faintly hypnotic quality. This was of some use in alleviating the equally hypnotic platitudinousness of his discourses. Perhaps you have read Anthony Pohl's tremendous 12-volume novel sequence, A Dance to the Music of Time. In it, a mysterious seer named Dr. Trelawney keeps his group of enlightened followers together in spite of various inevitable difficulties. These initiates can recognize each other not by the individuality of their garb, but by an exchange of vowels. On meeting, the first must intone, "The essence of the all is the Godhead of the true." The proper response to this is, "The vision of visions heals the blindness of sight." Thus is the spiritual handshake effected. I heard nothing at the Bhagwan's knee. One had to sit cross-legged. That was any more profound than that. There was more emphasis on love in its eternal sense than in Dr. Trelawney's circle, and certainly there was more emphasis on sex in its immediate sense, but on the whole, the instruction was innocuous. Or it would have been, if not for a sign at the entrance to the Bhagwan's preaching tent. This little sign never failed to irritate me. It read, "Shoes and minds must be left at the gate." There was a pile of shoes and sandals next to it, and in my transcendent condition I could almost picture a heap of abandoned and empty mentalities to round out this literally mindless little motto. I even attempted a brief parody of a Zen koan. What is the reflection of a mind discarded? For the blissed-out visitor or tourist, the ashram presented the outward aspect of a fine spiritual resort, where one could burble about the beyond in an exotic and luxurious setting. But within its holy precincts, as I soon discovered, there was a more sinister principle at work. Many damaged and distraught personalities came to Pune, seeking advice and counsel. Several of them were well off. The clients or pilgrims included a distant member of the British royal family, and were at first urged, as with so many faiths, to part with all their material possessions. Proof of the efficacy of this advice could be seen in the fleet of Rolls-Royce motor cars maintained by the Bhagwan, and deemed to be the largest such collection in the world. After this relatively brisk fleecing, initiates were transferred into group sessions where the really nasty business began. Wolfgang Dobrovolny's film Ashram, shot in secret by a former devotee and adapted for my documentary, shows the playful term Kundalini in a fresh light. In a representative scene, a young woman is stripped naked and surrounded by men who bark at her, drawing attention to all her physical and psychic shortcomings, until she's abject with tears and apologies. At this point, she is hugged and embraced and comforted and told that she now has a family. Sobbing with masochistic relief, she humbly enters the tribe. It was not absolutely clear what she had to do in order to be given her clothes back, but I did hear some believable and ugly testimony on this point. In other sessions involving men, things were rough enough for bones to be broken and lives lost. The German princeling of the House of Windsor was never seen again, and his body was briskly cremated without the tedium of an autopsy. I had been told in respectful and awed tones that the Bhagwan's body has some allergies, And not long after my sojourn, he fled the ashram and then apparently decided that he had no further use for his earthly frame. What happened to the Rolls-Royce collection, I never found out, but his acolytes received some kind of message to reconvene in the small town of Antelope, Oregon, in the early months of 1983, and this they did, though now less committed to the pacific and laid-back style. The local inhabitants were disconcerted to find an armed compound being erected in their neighbourhood, with unsmiling Orange Guard security forces. An attempt to create space for the new ashram was apparently made. In a bizarre episode, food poisoning matter was found to have been spread over the produce in an Antelope supermarket. Eventually, the commune broke up and dispersed amid serial recriminations, and I have occasionally run into empty-eyed refugees from the Bhagwan's long and misleading tuition. He himself has been reincarnated as Osho, in whose honour a glossy but stupid magazine was being produced until a few years ago. Possibly a remnant of his following still survives. I would say that the people of Antelope, Oregon, missed being as famous as Jonestown by a fairly narrow margin. El sueño de la razón produce monstruos. The sleep of reason, it has been well said, brings forth monsters. The immortal Francisco Goya gave us an etching with this title in his series Los Caprichos, where a man in defenseless slumber is hag-ridden by bats, owls, and other haunters of the darkness. But an extraordinary number of people appear to believe that the mind and the reasoning faculty, the only thing that divides us from our animal relatives, is something to be distrusted and even, as far as possible, dulled. The search for nirvana and the dissolution of the intellect goes on, and whenever it is tried, it produces a Kool-Aid effect in the real world. Make me one with everything. So goes the Buddhist's humble request to the hot dog vendor. But when the Buddhist hands over a $20 bill to the vendor, in return for his slathered bun, he waits a long time for his change. Finally asking for it, he is informed that change comes only from within. All such rhetoric is almost too easy to parody, as is that of missionary Christianity. In the old Anglican cathedral in Calcutta, I once paid a visit to the statue of Bishop Reginald Heber, who filled the hymn books of the Church of England with verses like these. What though the tropic breezes blow soft o'er Ceylon's isle, where every prospect pleases and only man is vile? What though with loving kindness the gifts of God are strewn, the heathen in his blindness bows down to wood and stone? It is partly in reaction to the condescension of old colonial boobies like this that many Westerners have come to revere the apparently more seductive religions of the Orient. Indeed, Sri Lanka, the modern name for the lovely island of Ceylon, is a place of great charm. Its people are remarkable for their kindness and generosity. How dare Bishop Heber have depicted them as vile? However, Sri Lanka is a country now almost utterly ruined and disfigured by violence and repression, and the contending forces are mainly Buddhist and Hindu. The problem begins with the very name of the state. Lanka is the old Sinhalese language name for the island, and the prefix Sri simply means holy, in the Buddhist sense of the word. This post-colonial renaming meant that the Tamils, who are chiefly Hindu, felt excluded at once. They prefer to call their homeland Elam. It did not take long for this ethnic tribalism, reinforced by religion, to wreck the society. Though I personally think that the Tamil population had a reasonable grievance against the central government, it is not possible to forgive their guerrilla leadership for pioneering, long before Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, the disgusting tactic of suicide murder. This barbarous technique, which was also used by them to assassinate an elected president of India, does not excuse the Buddhist-led pogroms against Tamils or the murder by a Buddhist priest of the first elected president of independent Sri Lanka. Conceivably, some readers of these pages will be shocked to learn of the existence of Hindu and Buddhist murderers and sadists. Perhaps they dimly imagine that contemplative Easterners devoted to vegetarian diets and meditative routines are immune to such temptations. It can even be argued that Buddhism is not, in our sense of the word, a religion at all. Nonetheless, the perfect one is alleged to have left one of his teeth behind in Sri Lanka, and I once attended a ceremony which involved a rare public showing by priests of this gold-encased object. Bishop Heber did not mention bone in his stupid hymn, though it would have made just as good a rhyme as stone. And perhaps this was because Christians have always foregathered to bow down to bones of supposed saints, and to keep them in grisly reliquaries in their churches and cathedrals. However, that may be, at the truth propitiation, I had no feeling at all of peace and inner bliss. To the contrary, I realized that if I was a Tamil, I would have a very good chance of being dismembered. The human species is an animal species without very much variation within it, and it's idle and futile to imagine that a voyage to Tibet, say, will discover an entirely different harmony with nature or eternity. The Dalai Lama, for example, is entirely and easily recognizable to a secularist. In exactly the same way as a medieval princeling, he makes the claim not just that Tibet should be independent of Chinese hegemony, a perfectly good demand, if I may render it into everyday English, but that he himself is a hereditary king appointed by heaven itself. How convenient. Dissenting sects within his faith are persecuted. His one-man rule in an Indian enclave is absolute. He makes absurd pronouncements about sex and diet, and when on his trips to Hollywood fundraisers, anoints major donors like Steven Seagal and Richard Gere as holy. Indeed, even Mr. Gere was moved to whine a bit when Mr. Seagal was invested as a tulku, or person of high enlightenment. It must be annoying to be outbid at such a spiritual auction. I will admit that the current Dalai or Supreme Lama is a man of some charm and presence, as I will admit that the present Queen of England is a person of more integrity than most of her predecessors. But this does not invalidate the critique of hereditary monarchy, and the first foreign visitors to Tibet were downright appalled at the feudal domination and hideous punishments that kept the population in permanent serfdom to a parasitic monastic elite. How might one easily prove that Eastern faith was identical with the unverifiable assumptions of Western religion? Here is a decided statement by Gudo, a very celebrated Japanese Buddhist of the first part of the 20th century. As a propagator of Buddhism, I teach that all sentient beings have the Buddha nature, and that within the Dharma there is equality with neither superior nor inferior. Furthermore, I teach that all sentient beings are my children. Having taken these golden words as the basis of my faith, I discovered that they are in complete agreement with the principles of socialism. It was thus that I became a believer in socialism. There you have it again. A baseless assumption that some undefined external force has a mind of its own, and the faint but menacing suggestion that anyone who disagrees is in some fashion opposed to the holy or paternal will. I excerpt this passage from Brian Victoria's exemplary book Zen at War, which describes the way the majority of Japanese Buddhists decided that Gudo was right in general, but wrong in particular. People were indeed to be considered children, as they are by all faiths, but it was actually fascism and not socialism that the Buddha and the Dharma required of them. Mr. Victoria is a Buddhist adept and claims, I leave this to him, to be a priest as well. He certainly takes his faith seriously and knows a great deal about Japan and the Japanese. His study of the question shows that Japanese Buddhism became a loyal servant, even an advocate, of imperialism and mass murder, and that it did so not so much because it was Japanese, but because it was Buddhist. In 1938, leading members of the Nichiren sect founded a group devoted to Imperial Way Buddhism. It declared as follows. Imperial Way Buddhism utilizes the exquisite truth of the Lotus Sutra to reveal the majestic essence of the national polity. Exalting the true spirit of Mahayana Buddhism is a teaching which reverently supports the emperor's work. This is what the great founder of our sect, Saint Nichiren, meant when he referred to the divine unity of sovereign and Buddha. For this reason, the principal image of adoration in Imperial Way Buddhism is not Buddha Shakyamuni, who appeared in India, but His Majesty the Emperor, whose lineage extends over 10,000 generations. Effusions like this are, however wicked they may be, almost beyond criticism. They consist, like most professions of faith, in merely assuming what has to be proved. Thus, a bald assertion is then followed with the words, "for this reason," as if all the logical work had been done by making the assertion. All of the statements of the Dalai Lama, who happens not to advocate imperialist slaughter, but who did loudly welcome the Indian government's nuclear tests, are also of this non sequitur type. Scientists have an expression for hypotheses that are utterly useless even for learning from mistakes. They refer to them as being not even wrong. Most so-called spiritual discourse is of this type. You will notice further that in the view of this school of Buddhism, there are other schools of Buddhism, every bit as contemplative, that are in error. This is just what an anthropologist of religion would expect to find of something that was, having been manufactured, doomed to be schismatic. But on what basis could a devotee of Buddha Shakyamuni argue that his Japanese co-thinkers were in error themselves? Certainly not by using reasoning or evidence, which are quite alien to those who talk of the exquisite truth of the Lotus Sutra. Things went from bad to worse once Japanese generals had mobilized their Zen-obedient zombies into complete obedience. The mainland of China became a killing field, and all the major sects of Japanese Buddhism united to issue the following proclamation. Revering the imperial policy of preserving the Orient, the subjects of Imperial Japan bear the humanitarian destiny of 1 billion people of color. We believe it is time to effect a major change in the course of human history, which has been centered on Caucasians. This echoes the line taken by the Shinto, another quasi-religion enjoying state support, that Japanese soldiers really fell for the cause of Asian independence. Every year there is a famous controversy about whether Japan's civil and spiritual leaders should visit the Yakasuni Shrine, which officially ennobles Hirohito's army. Every year, millions of Chinese and Koreans and Burmese protest that Japan was not the enemy of imperialism in the Orient, but a newer and more vicious form of it, and that the Yakasuni Shrine is a place of horror. How interesting, however, to note that Japanese Buddhists of the time regarded their country's membership of the Nazi-fascist Axis as a manifestation of liberation theology. Or, as the United Buddhist leadership phrased it at the time, in order to establish eternal peace in East Asia, arousing the great benevolence and compassion of Buddhism, we are sometimes accepting and sometimes forceful. We now have no choice but to exercise the benevolent forcefulness of killing one in order that many may live. Isatsu Tasho. This is something which Mahayana Buddhism approves of, only with the greatest of seriousness. No holy war or crusade advocate could have put it better. The eternal peace bit is particularly excellent. By the end of the dreadful conflict that Japan had started, it was Buddhist and Shinto priests who were recruiting and training the suicide bombers, or kamikaze, divine wind, fanatics, assuring them that the emperor was a golden wheel-turning sacred king, one indeed of the four manifestations of the ideal Buddhist monarch, and a Tathagata, or fully enlightened being, of the material world. And, since Zen treats life and death indifferently, why not abandon the cares of this world and adopt a policy of prostration at the feet of a homicidal dictator? This grisly case also helps to undergird my general case for considering faith as a threat. It ought to be possible for me to pursue my studies and researches in one house and for the Buddhist to spin his wheel in another. But contempt for the intellect has a strange way of not being passive. One of two things may happen. Those who are innocently credulous may become easy prey for those who are less scrupulous and who seek to lead and inspire them. Or those whose credulity has led their own society into stagnation may seek a solution, not in true self-examination, but in blaming others for their backwardness. Both these things happened in the most consecratedly spiritual society of them all. Although many Buddhists now regret that deplorable attempt to prove their own superiority, no Buddhist since then has been able to demonstrate that Buddhism was wrong in its own terms. A faith that despises the mind and the free individual, that preaches submission and resignation, and that regards life as a poor and transient thing, is ill-equipped for self-criticism. Those who become bored by conventional Bible religions and seek enlightenment by way of the dissolution of their own critical faculties into nirvana in any form had better take a warning. They may think they are leaving the realm of despised materialism, but they are still being asked to put their reason to sleep and to discard their minds along with their sandals. Chapter 15. Religion as an Original Sin. There are indeed several ways in which religion is not just amoral but positively immoral. And these faults and crimes are not to be found in the behavior of its adherents, which can sometimes be exemplary, but in its original precepts. These include presenting a false picture of the world to the innocent and the credulous, the doctrine of blood sacrifice, the doctrine of atonement, the doctrine of eternal reward and or punishment, the imposition of impossible tasks and rules. The first point has already been covered. All the creation myths of all peoples have long been known to be false, and have fairly recently been replaced by infinitely superior and more magnificent explanations. To its list of apologies, religion should simply add an apology for foisting man-made parchments and folk myths upon the unsuspecting, and for taking so long to concede that this had been done. One senses a reluctance to make this admission, since it might tend to explode the whole religious worldview, but the longer it is delayed, the more heinous the denial will become. Blood sacrifice. Before monotheism arose, the altars of primitive society reeked of blood, much of it human and some of it infant. The thirst for this, at least in animal form, is still with us. Pious Jews are at this moment trying to breed the spotlessly pure red heifer, mentioned in the Book of Numbers, chapter 19, which, if slaughtered again according to the exact and meticulous ritual, will bring about the return of animal sacrifices in the Third Temple and hasten the end of time and the coming of the Messiah. This may appear merely absurd, but a team of like-minded Christian maniac farmers are attempting, as I write, to help their co-fundamentalists by employing special breeding techniques, borrowed or stolen from modern science, to produce a perfect red Angus beast in Nebraska. Meanwhile, in Israel, the Jewish biblical fanatics are also trying to raise a human child in a pure bubble, free from contamination, who will, at the attainment of the right age, be privileged to cut that heifer's throat. Ideally, this should be done on the Temple Mount, awkwardly the site of the Muslim holy places, but nonetheless the very spot where Abraham is alleged to have drawn the knife over the live body of his own child. Other sacramental guttings and throat cuttings, particularly of lambs, occur every year in the Christian and Muslim world, either to celebrate Easter or the Feast of Eid. The latter, which honours Abraham's willingness to make a human sacrifice of his son, is common to all three monotheisms and descends from their primitive ancestors. There is no softening the plain meaning of this frightful story. The prelude involves a series of vilenesses and delusions, from the seduction of Lot by both his daughters, to the marriage of Abraham to his stepsister, the birth of Isaac to Sarah when Abraham was 100 years old, and many other credible and incredible rustic crimes and misdemeanors. Perhaps afflicted by a poor conscience, but at any rate believing himself commanded by God, Abraham agreed to murder his son. He prepared the kindling, laid the tied-up boy upon it, thus showing that he knew the procedure, and took up the knife in order to kill the child like an animal. At the last available moment his hand was stayed, not by God, as it happens, but by an angel, and he was praised from the clouds for showing his sturdy willingness to murder an innocent in expiation of his own crimes. As a reward for his fealty, he was promised a large and long posterity. Not long after this, though the Genesis narrative is not very well illustrated in point of time, his wife Sarah expired at the age of 127, and her dutiful husband found her a place of burial in a cave in the town of Hebron. Having outlived her by attaining the fine old age of 175, and having fathered six more children meanwhile, Abraham was eventually buried in the same cave. To this day, religious people kill each other and kill each other's children for the right to exclusive property in this unidentifiable and unlocatable hole in a hill. There was a terrible massacre of Jewish residents of Hebron during the Arab Revolt of 1929, when 67 Jews were slaughtered. Many of these were Lubavitchers, who regard all non-Jews as racially inferior, and who had moved to Hebron because they believed the Genesis myth, but this does not excuse the pogrom. Remaining outside the border of Israel until 1967, the town was captured that year with much fanfare by Israeli forces and became part of the occupied West Bank. Jewish settlers began to return under the leadership of a particularly violent and obnoxious rabbi named Moshe Levinger, and to build an armed settlement named Kiryat Arba above the town, as well as some smaller settlements within it. The Muslims, among the mainly Arab inhabitants, continued to claim that the praiseworthy Abraham indeed had been willing to murder his son, but only for their religion and not for the Jews. This is what submission means. When I visited the place, I found that the supposed Cave of the Patriarchs, or Cave of Machpelah, had separate entrances and separate places of worship for the two warring claimants to the right to celebrate this atrocity in their own names. A short while before I arrived, another atrocity had occurred. An Israeli zealot named Dr. Baruch Goldstein had come to the cave and, unslinging the automatic weapon that he was allowed to carry, discharged it into the Muslim congregation. He killed 27 worshippers and injured countless others before being overwhelmed and beaten to death. It turned out that many people already knew that Dr. Goldstein was dangerous. While serving as a physician in the Israeli army, he had announced that he would not treat non-Jewish patients, such as Israeli Arabs, especially on the Sabbath. As it happens, he was obeying rabbinic law in declining to do this, as many Israeli religious courts have confirmed. So an easy way to spot an inhumane killer was to notice that he was guided by a sincere and literal observance of the divine instruction. Shrines in his name have been set up by the more doggedly observant Jews ever since, and of those rabbis who condemned his action, not all did so in unequivocal terms. The curse of Abraham continues to poison Hebron, but the religious warrant for blood sacrifice poisons our entire civilization. Atonement. Previous sacrifices of humans, such as the Aztec and other ceremonies from which we recoil, were common in the ancient world and took the form of propitiatory murder. An offering of a virgin or an infant or a prisoner was assumed to appease the gods. Once again, not a very good advertisement for the moral properties of religion. Martyrdom, or a deliberate sacrifice of oneself, can be viewed in a slightly different light, though when practiced by the Hindus in the form of sati, or the strongly suggested suicide of widows, it was put down by the British in India for imperial as much as for Christian reasons. Those martyrs who wish to kill others as well as themselves in an act of religious exaltation are viewed more differently still. Islam is ostensibly opposed to suicide per se, but cannot seem to decide whether to condemn or recommend the act of such a bold shaheed. However, the idea of a vicarious atonement, of the sort that so much troubled even C.S. Lewis, is a further refinement of the ancient superstition. Once again we have a father demonstrating love by subjecting a son to death by torture, but this time the father is not trying to impress God. He is God, and he's trying to impress humans. Ask yourself the question, how moral is the following? I am told of a human sacrifice that took place 2,000 years ago, without my wishing it, and in circumstances so ghastly that, had I been present and in possession of any influence, I would have been duty-bound to try and stop it. In consequence of this murder, my own manifold sins are forgiven me, and I may hope to enjoy everlasting life. Let us just for now overlook all the contradictions between the tellers of the original story and assume that it is basically true. What are the further implications? They are not as reassuring as they look at first sight. For a start, and in order to gain the benefit of this wondrous offer, I have to accept that I am responsible for the flogging and mocking and crucifixion, in which I had no say and no part, and agree that every time I decline this responsibility, or that I sin in word or deed, I am intensifying the agony of it. Furthermore, I am required to believe that the agony was necessary in order to compensate for an earlier crime in which I also had no part, the sin of Adam. It is useless to object that Adam seems to have been created with insatiable discontent and curiosity, and then forbidden to slake it. All this was settled long before even Jesus himself was born. Thus my own guilt in the matter is deemed original and inescapable. However, I am still granted free will with which to reject the offer of vicarious redemption. Should I exercise this choice, however, I face an eternity of torture much more awful than anything endured at Calvary, or anything threatened to those who first heard the Ten Commandments. The tale is made no easier to follow by the necessary realization that Jesus both wished and needed to die and came to Jerusalem at Passover in order to do so, and that all who took part in his murder were unknowingly doing God's will and fulfilling ancient prophecies. Absent the Gnostic version, this makes it hopelessly odd that Judas, who allegedly performed the strangely redundant act of identifying a very well-known preacher to those who had been hunting for him, should suffer such opprobrium. Without him, there could have been no Good Friday, as the Christians naively call it, even when they are not in a vengeful mood. There is a charge found in only one of the four Gospels that the Jews who condemned Jesus asked for his blood to be on their heads for future generations. This is not a problem that concerns only the Jews, or those Catholics who are worried by the history of Christian antisemitism. Suppose that the Jewish Sanhedrin had in fact made such a call, as Maimonides thought they had and should have. How could that call possibly be binding upon successor generations? Remember that the Vatican did not assert that it was some Jews who had killed Christ. It asserted that it was the Jews who had ordered his death, and that the Jewish people as a whole were the bearers of a collective responsibility. It seems bizarre that the Church could not bring itself to drop the charge of generalized Jewish deicide until very recently. But the key to its reluctance is easy to find. If you once admit that the descendants of Jews are not implicated, it becomes very hard to argue that anyone else not there present was implicated either. One rent in the fabric, as usual, threatens to tear the whole thing apart, or to make it into something simply man-made and woven, like the discredited Shroud of Turin. The collectivization of guilt, in short, is immoral in itself, as religion has been occasionally compelled to admit. Eternal punishment and impossible tasks. The gospel story of the Garden of Gethsemane used to absorb me very much as a child, because its break in the action and its human whimper made me wonder if some of the fantastic scenario might after all be true. Jesus asks, in effect, "Do I have to go through with this?" It is an impressive and unforgettable question, and I long ago decided that I would cheerfully wager my own soul on the belief that the only right answer to it is no. We cannot, like fear-ridden peasants of antiquity, hope to load all our crimes onto a goat and then drive the hapless animal into the desert. Our everyday idiom is quite sound in regarding scapegoating with contempt, and religion is scapegoating writ large. I can pay your debt, my love, if you have been imprudent, and if I were a hero, like Sidney Carton in A Tale of Two Cities, I could even serve your term in prison, or take your place on the scaffold. Greater love hath no man, but I cannot absolve you of your responsibilities. It would be immoral of me to offer, and immoral of you to accept. And if the same offer is made from another time and another world, through the mediation of middlemen and accompanied by inducements, it loses all its grandeur and becomes debased into wish-thinking or worse, a combination of blackmailing with bribery. The ultimate degeneration of all this into a mere bargain was made unpleasantly obvious by Blaise Pascal, whose theology is not far short of sordid. His celebrated wager puts it in hucksterish form. What have you got to lose? If you believe in God and there is a God, you win. If you believe in him and you're wrong, so what? I once wrote a response to this cunning piece of bet covering, which took two forms. The first was a version of Bertrand Russell's hypothetical reply to the hypothetical question, what will you say if you die and are confronted with your Maker? His response? I should say, O God, you did not give us enough evidence. My own reply? Imponderable, sir, I presume from some, if not all of your many reputations, that you might prefer honest and convinced unbelief to the hypocritical and self-interested affectation of faith or the smoking tributes of bloody altars. But I would not count on it. Pascal reminds me of the hypocrites and frauds who abound in Talmudic Jewish rationalization. Don't do any work on the Sabbath yourself, but pay someone else to do it. You obeyed the letter of the law, who's counting? The Dalai Lama tells us that you can visit a prostitute as long as someone else pays her. Shia Muslims offer temporary marriage, selling men the permission to take a wife for an hour or two with the usual vows, and then divorce her when they're done. Half of the splendid buildings in Rome would never have been raised if the sale of indulgences had not been so profitable. St. Peter's itself was financed by a special one-time offer of that kind. The newest pope, the former Joseph Ratzinger, recently attracted Catholic youths to a festival by offering a certain remission of sin to those who attended. This pathetic moral spectacle would not be necessary if the original rules were ones that it would be possible to obey. But to the totalitarian edicts that begin with revelation from absolute authority, and that are enforced by fear and based on a sin that had been committed long ago, are added regulations that are often immoral and impossible at the same time. The essential principle of totalitarianism is to make laws that are impossible to obey. The resulting tyranny is even more impressive if it can be enforced by a privileged caste or party, which is highly zealous in the detection of error. Most of humanity throughout its history has dwelt under a form of this stupefying dictatorship, and a large portion of it still does. Allow me to give a few examples of the rules that must, yet cannot, be followed. The commandment at Sinai which forbade people even to think about coveting goods is the first clue. It is echoed in the New Testament by the injunction which says that a man who looks upon a woman in the wrong way has actually committed adultery already, and it is almost equaled by the current Muslim and former Christian prohibition against lending out money at interest. All of these, in their different fashion, attempt to place impossible restraints on human initiative. They can only be met in one of two ways. The first is by a continual scourging and mortification of the flesh, accompanied by incessant wrestling with impure thoughts, which become actual as soon as they are named or even imagined. From this come hysterical confessions of guilt, false promises of improvement, and loud, violent denunciations of other backsliders and sinners, a spiritual police state. The second solution is organized hypocrisy, where forbidden foods are rebaptized as something else, or where a donation to the religious authorities will purchase some wiggle room, or where ostentatious orthodoxy will buy some time, or where money can be paid into one account and then paid back, with perhaps a slight percentage added, in a non-usurious manner, into another. This we might term the spiritual banana republic. Many theocracies, from medieval Rome to modern Wahhabi Saudi Arabia, have managed to be spiritual police states and spiritual banana republics at the same time. This objection applies even to some of the noblest and some of the basest rules. The order to love thy neighbour is mild and yet stern, a reminder of one's duty to others. The order to love thy neighbour as thyself is too extreme and too strenuous to be obeyed, as is the hard-to-interpret instruction to love others as I have loved you. Humans are not so constituted as to care for others as much as themselves. The thing simply cannot be done, as any intelligent creator would well understand from studying his own design. Urging humans to be superhumans, on pain of death and torture, is the urging of terrible self-abasement at their repeated and inevitable failure to keep the rules. What a grin, meanwhile, on the face of those who accept the cash donations that are made in lieu. The so-called golden rule, sometimes needlessly identified with a folk tale about the Babylonian Rabbi Hillel, simply enjoins us to treat others as one would wish to be treated by them. This sober and rational precept, which one can teach to any child with its innate sense of fairness, and which predates all Jesus' beatitudes and parables, is well within the compass of any atheist and does not require masochism and hysteria or sadism and hysteria when it is breached. It is gradually learned as part of the painfully slow evolution of the species, and once grasped is never forgotten. Ordinary conscience will do, without any heavenly wrath behind it. As to the basest rules, one need only consult the argument from design once more. People wish to enrich and better themselves, and though they may well lend or even give money to a friend or relative in need, and ask for nothing but its eventual return or its grateful acknowledgement, they will not advance money to perfect strangers without expecting interest. By a nice chance, cupidity and avarice are the spur to economic development. No student of the subject, from David Ricardo to Karl Marx to Adam Smith, has been unaware of this fact. "It is not from the benevolence of the baker," observed Smith in his shrewd Scots manner, "that we expect our daily bread, but from his self-interest in baking and selling it. In any case, one may choose to be altruistic, whatever that may mean, but by definition one may not be compelled into altruism. Perhaps we would be better mammals if we were not made this way, but surely nothing could be sillier than having a maker who then forbade the very same instinct he instilled." "Free will," reply the casuists. "You do not have to obey the laws against murder or theft either." Well, one may be genetically programmed for a certain amount of aggression and hatred and greed, and yet also evolved enough to beware of following every prompting. If we gave in to our base instinct every time, civilization would have been impossible, and there would be no writing in which to continue this argument. However, there can be no question that a human being, whether standing up or lying down, finds his or her hand resting just next to the genitalia. Useful, no doubt, in warding off primeval aggressors once our ancestors decided to take the risk of going erect and exposing the viscera, this is both a privilege and a provocation denied to most quadrupeds, some of whom can compensate by getting their mouths to the same point that we can only reach with our fingers and palms. Now, who devised the rule that this easy apposition between the manual and the genital be forbidden, even as a thought? To put it more plainly, who ordered that you must touch, for other reasons having nothing to do with sex or reproduction, but also that you must not? There does not even seem to be any true scriptural authority here, yet almost all religions have made the prohibition a near absolute one. One could write an entire book that was devoted only to the grotesque history of religion and sex, and to holy dread of the procreative act and its associated impulses and necessities, from the emission of semen to the effusion of menstrual blood. But a convenient way of condensing the whole fascinating story may be to ask one single provocative question. Chapter 16. Is Religion Child Abuse? "Tell me straight out, I call on you. Answer me. Imagine that you yourself are building the edifice of human destiny with the object of making people happy in the finale, of giving them peace and rest at last. But for that you must inevitably and unavoidably torture just one tiny creature, that same child who was beating her chest with a little fist, and raise your edifice on the foundation of her unrequited tears. Would you agree to be the architect on such conditions? Tell me the truth." Ivan to Alyosha in The Brothers Karamazov. When we consider whether religion has done more harm than good, not that this would say anything at all about its truth or authenticity, we are faced with an imponderably large question. How can we ever know how many children had their psychological and physical lives irreparably maimed by the compulsory inculcation of faith? This is almost as hard to determine as the number of spiritual and religious dreams and visions that came true, which in order to possess even a minimal claim to value would have to be measured against all the unrecorded and unremembered ones that did not. But we can be sure that religion has always hoped to practice upon the unformed and undefended minds of the young, and has gone to great lengths to make sure of this privilege by making alliances with secular powers in the material world. One of the great instances of moral terrorism in our literature is the sermon preached by Father Arnall in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. This disgusting old priest is readying Stephen Dedalus and his other young charges for a retreat in honour of St. Francis Xavier, the man who brought the Inquisition to Asia, and whose bones are still revered by those who choose to revere bones. He decides to impress them with a long and gloating account of eternal punishment, of the sort which the Church used to mandate when it still had the confidence to do so. It is impossible to quote the entire rant, but two particularly vivid elements concerning the nature of torture and the nature of time are of interest. It is easy to see that the priest's words are designed precisely to frighten children. In the first place, the images are themselves childlike. In the torture section, the very devil himself makes a mountain shrivel like wax. Every frightening malady is summoned, and the childlike worry that this pain might go on forever is deftly played upon. When it comes to the picture of a unit of time, we see a child on the beach playing with grains of sand, and then the infantile magnification of units. Daddy, what if there were a million, million, million squillion kittens? Would they fill up the whole world? And then, adding further multiplicities, the evocation of nature's leaves and the easily conjured fur and feathers and scales of the family pet. For centuries, grown men have been paid to frighten children in this way, and to torture and beat and violate them as well, as they also did in Joyce's memory and the memory of countless others. The other man-made stupidities and cruelties of the religious are easy to detect as well. The idea of torture is as old as the nastiness of mankind, which is the only species with the imagination to guess what it might feel like when imposed upon another. We cannot blame religion for this impulse, but we can condemn it for institutionalizing and refining the practice. The museums of medieval Europe, from Holland to Tuscany, are crammed with instruments and devices upon which holy men labored devoutly in order to see how long they could keep someone alive while being roasted. It is not needful to go into further details, but there were also religious books of instruction in this art and guides for the detection of heresy by pain. Those who were not lucky enough to be allowed to take part in the auto da fe, or act of faith, as a torture session was known, were permitted free rein to fantasize as many lurid nightmares as they could and to inflict them verbally in order to keep the ignorant in a state of permanent fear. In an era where there was little enough by way of public entertainment, a good public burning or disembowelment or breaking on the wheel was often as much recreation as the saintly dared to allow. Nothing proves the man-made character of religion as obviously as the sick mind that designed hell, unless it is the sorely limited mind that has failed to describe heaven, except as a place of either worldly comfort, eternal tedium, or, as Tertullian thought, continual relish in the torture of others. Pre-Christian hells were highly unpleasant too, and called upon the same sadistic ingenuity for their invention. However, some of the early ones we know of, most notably the Hindu, were limited in time. A sinner, for example, might be sentenced to a given number of years in hell, where every day counted as 6,400 human years. If he slew a priest, the sentence thus adjusted would be 149,504,000,000 years. At this point, he was allowed nirvana, which seems to mean annihilation. It was left to Christians to find a hell from which there was no possible appeal. And the idea is easily plagiarized. I once heard Louis Farrakhan, leader of the heretical black-only Nation of Islam, as he drew a hideous roar from a mob in Madison Square Garden. Hurling spittle at the Jews, he yelled, "And don't you forget, when it's God who puts you in the ovens, it's forever." The obsession with children and with rigid control over their upbringing has been part of every system of absolute authority. It may have been a Jesuit who was first actually quoted as saying, "Give me the child until he is 10 and I'll give you the man," but the idea is very much older than the school of Ignatius Loyola. Indoctrination of the young often has the reverse effect, as we also know from the fate of many secular ideologies. But it seems that the religious will run this risk in order to imprint the average boy or girl with enough propaganda. What else can they hope to do? If religious instruction were not allowed until the child had attained the age of reason, we would be living in a quite different world. Faithful parents are divided over this, since they naturally hope to share the wonders and delights of Christmas and other fiestas with their offspring, and can also make good use of God as well as of lesser figures, like Santa Claus, to help tame the unruly. But mark what happens if the child should stray to another faith, let alone another cult, even in early adolescence. The parents will tend to proclaim that this is taking advantage of the innocent. All monotheisms have, or used to have, a very strong prohibition against apostasy for just this reason. In her memories of a Catholic girlhood, Mary McCarthy remembers her shock at learning from a Jesuit preacher that her Protestant grandfather, her guardian and friend, was doomed to eternal punishment because he had been baptized in the wrong way. A precociously intelligent child, she would not let the matter drop until she had made the Mother Superior consult some higher authorities, and discover a loophole in the writings of Bishop Athanasius, who held that heretics were only damned if they rejected the true church with full awareness of what they were doing. Her grandfather then might be sufficiently unaware of the true church to evade hell. But what an agony to which to subject an 11-year-old girl. And only think of the number of less curious children who simply accepted this evil teaching without questioning it. Those who lie to the young in this way are wicked in the extreme. Two instances, one of immoral teaching and the other of immoral practice, may be adduced. The immoral teaching concerns abortion. As a materialist, I think it has been demonstrated that an embryo is a separate body and entity, and not merely, as some really did used to argue, a growth on or in the female body. There used to be feminists who would say that it was more like an appendix or even, this was seriously maintained, a tumour. That nonsense seems to have stopped. Of the considerations that have stopped it, one is the fascinating and moving view provided by the sonogram, and another is the survival of premature babies of feather-like weight who have achieved viability outside the womb. This is yet another way in which science can make common cause with humanism. Just as no human being of average moral capacity could be indifferent to the sight of a woman being kicked in the stomach, so nobody could fail to be far more outraged if the woman in question was pregnant. Embryology confirms morality. The words unborn child, even when used in a politicized manner, describe a material reality. However, this only opens the argument rather than closes it. There may be many circumstances in which it is not desirable to carry a fetus to full term. Either nature or God appears to appreciate this, since a very large number of pregnancies are aborted, so to speak, because of malformations, and are politely known as miscarriages. Sad though this is, it is probably less miserable an outcome than the vast number of deformed or idiot children who would otherwise have been born or stillborn, or whose brief lives would have been a torment to themselves and others. As with evolution in general, therefore, in utero we see a microcosm of nature and evolution itself. In the first place, we begin as tiny forms that are amphibian, before gradually developing lungs and brains, and growing and shedding that now useless coat of fur, and then struggling out and breathing fresh air after a somewhat difficult transition. Likewise, the system is fairly pitiless in eliminating those who never had a very good chance of surviving in the first place. Our ancestors on the savannah were not going to survive in their turn if they had a clutch of sickly and lolling infants to protect against predators. Here, the analogy of evolution might not be to Adam Smith's invisible hand, a term that I have always distrusted, so much as to Joseph Schumpeter's model of creative destruction, whereby we accustom ourselves to a certain amount of natural failure, taking into account the pitilessness of nature and extending back to the remote prototypes of our species. Thus, not all conceptions are or ever were going to lead to births, and ever since the mere struggle for existence began to abate, it has been an ambition of the human intelligence to gain control over the rate of reproduction. Families who are at the mercy of mere nature, with its inevitable demand for profusion, will be tied to a cycle that is not much better than animal. The best way of achieving a measure of control is by prophylaxis, which has been restlessly sought since records were kept, and which has in our own time become relatively foolproof and painless. The second best fallback solution, which sometimes may be desirable for other reasons, is termination of pregnancy, an expedient which is regretted by many even when it's been undertaken in dire need. All thinking people recognize a painful conflict of rights and interests in this question, and strive to achieve a balance. The only proposition that is completely useless, either morally or practically, is the wild statement that sperms and eggs are all potential lives, which must not be prevented from fusing, and that, when united however briefly, have souls and must be protected by law. On this basis, an intrauterine device that prevents the attachment of the egg to the wall of the uterus is a murder weapon, and an ectopic pregnancy, the disastrous accident that causes the egg to begin growing inside the fallopian tube, is a human life, instead of an already doomed egg that is also an urgent threat to the life of the mother. Every single step toward the clarification of this argument has been opposed root and branch by the clergy. The attempt even to educate people in the possibility of family planning was anathematized from the first, and its early advocates and teachers were arrested, like John Stuart Mill, or put in jail or thrown out of their jobs. Only a few years ago, Mother Teresa denounced contraception as the moral equivalent of abortion, which logically meant, since she regarded abortion as murder, that a sheath or a pill was a murder weapon also. She was a little more fanatical even than her church, but here again we can see that the strenuous and the dogmatic is the moral enemy of the good. It demands that we believe the impossible and practice the unfeasible, by those who use unborn children as well as born ones, as mere manipulable objects of their doctrine. As to immoral practice, it is hard to imagine anything more grotesque than the mutilation of infant genitalia, nor is it easy to imagine anything more incompatible with the argument from design. We must assume that a designer god would pay special attention to the reproductive organs of his creatures, which are so essential for the continuation of the species. But religious ritual, since the dawn of time, has insisted on snatching children from the cradle and taking sharp stones or knives to their pudenda. In some animist and Muslim societies, it is the female babies who suffer the worst, with the excision of the labia and the clitoris. This practice is sometimes postponed to adolescence and, as earlier described, accompanied by infibulation or the sewing up of the vagina, with only a small aperture for the passage of blood and urine. The aim is clear: to kill or dull the girl's sexual instinct and destroy the temptation to experiment with any man, save the one to whom she will be given, and who will have the privilege of rending those threads on the dreaded nuptial night. Meanwhile, she will be taught that her monthly visitation of blood is a curse. All religions have expressed a horror of it, and many still prohibit menstruating women from attending service, and that she is an unclean vessel. In other cultures, notably the Judeo-Christian, it is the sexual mutilation of small boys that is insisted upon. For some reason, little girls can be Jewish without genital alteration. It is useless to look for consistency in the covenants that people believe they have made with God. Here, the original motives appear to be twofold. The shedding of blood, which is insisted upon at circumcision ceremonies, is most probably a symbolic survival from the animal and human sacrifices, which were such a feature of the gore-soaked landscape of the Old Testament. By adhering to the practice, parents could offer to sacrifice a part of the child as a stand-in for the whole. Objections to interference with something that God must have designed with care, the human penis, were overcome by the invented dogma that Adam was born circumcised and in the image of God. Indeed, it is argued by some rabbis that Moses, too, was born circumcised, though this claim may result from the fact that his own circumcision is nowhere mentioned in the Pentateuch. The second purpose, very unambivalently stated by Maimonides, was the same as for girls: the destruction, as far as possible, of the pleasurable side of sexual intercourse. Here is what the sage tells us in his Guide to the Perplexed. With regard to circumcision, one of the reasons for it is, in my opinion, the wish to bring about a decrease in sexual intercourse, and a weakening of the organ in question, so that this activity be diminished, and the organ be in as quiet a state as possible. It has been thought that circumcision perfects what is defective congenitally. How can natural things be defective, so that they need to be perfected from outside? All the more because we know how useful the foreskin is for that member. In fact, this commandment has not been prescribed with a view to perfecting what is defective congenitally, but to perfecting what is defective morally. The bodily pain caused to that member is the real purpose of circumcision. The fact that circumcision weakens the faculty of sexual excitement and sometimes perhaps diminishes the pleasure is indubitable. For if at birth this member has been made to bleed and has had its covering taken away from it, it must indubitably be weakened. Maimonides did not seem particularly impressed by the promise made to Abraham in Genesis 17 that circumcision would lead to his having a vast progeny at the age of 99. Abraham's decision to circumcise his slaves as well as his male household was a side issue, or perhaps an effect of enthusiasm, since these non-Jews were not part of the covenant. But he did circumcise his son Ishmael, who was then 13. Ishmael only had to part with his foreskin. His younger brother Isaac, oddly described as Abraham's only son in Genesis 22, was circumcised when he was 8 days old, but later offered as a sacrifice in his whole person. Maimonides also argued that circumcision would be a means of reinforcing ethnic solidarity, and he laid particular stress on the need to perform the operation on babies, rather than on those who had reached the age of reason. The first argument is that if the child were let alone until he grew up, he would sometimes not perform it. The second is that a child does not suffer as much pain as a grown-up man, because his membrane is still soft and his imagination weak, for a grown-up man would regard the thing which he would imagine before it occurred as terrible and hard. The third is that the parents of a child that is just born take lightly matters concerning it, for up to that time the imaginative form that compels the parents to love it is not yet consolidated. Consequently, if it were left uncircumcised for 2 or 3 years, this would necessitate the abandonment of circumcision because of the father's love and affection for it. At the time of its birth, on the other hand, this imaginative form is very weak, especially as far as concerns the father upon whom this commandment is imposed. In ordinary words, Maimonides is perfectly aware that, if not supposedly mandated by God, this hideous procedure would, even in the most devout parent, he stipulates only a father, create a natural revulsion in favour of the child. But he represses this insight in favour of divine law. In more recent times, some pseudo-secular arguments have been adduced for male